What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, producer of 411 Teen. Travis Waters' compelling memoir, The West Coast Kid, My Redemption, chronicles the events that led up to his taking a very different path, away from college and into the dangerous world of drug smuggling. He shares his inspiring story in hopes to encourage young folks to make positive, healthy choices in life. Travis, welcome to 411 Teen.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yes. Share with us, why did you decide to write the book?
I wrote the book. I promised myself, I was in the state prison in Florida, and after one of my beatings, I was laying on my bed.
After one of your what?
After one of my beatings in prison. Beatings in prison.
Okay, I thought I heard you. I just want to make sure.
I said, if I make it out of here alive, I'm going to do everything I can to help kids, to let kids know the realities of what happens when you mess with drugs and you go down that wrong road. And if I make it out of here alive, I will do everything I can to let them know that in reality what really happens to you. And that's what inspired me to write The West Coast Kid. I came home from prison and newspaper articles were started, did some stories on my life about me attending, my son attending my coach's, legendary coach's basketball camp. And they did a story in my life there talking about me being the school's first great player and holding records. Then I threw a big party for my retirement party for my legendary coach here in Florida, in South Florida. And then that's when the publishing companies, they did another story in my life, and the publishing company started calling me to do a tell-all book, and that's when I was able to spread my message.
Okay. Tell us about the significance of the title, The West Coast Kid.
It was the title, was the name, because I was on the west coast of Florida, and I was bringing in loads of marijuana from Colombia and through the Miami gangs, Colombia cartels and the Miami gangs on the east coast of Florida, and I was just a kid, 18 years old, 19 years old, and that's the name was the West Coast Kid. That's what they nicknamed me, the West Coast Kid, the CIA, the cartels and everything.
Oh.
So I was the West Coast Kid. And my redemption is redeeming myself.
Travis,
help others and give back to the community.
How did this happen?
How did me getting involved
yes.
with drugs happen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like a lot of kids in these inner cities, and even kids that live out in the country, you're influenced by older people, peers. You think it's cool dealing drugs, getting involved with drugs. I've seen family members, cousins, and friends doing it in coolers full of money, and I wanted that lifestyle. I had scholarships to play ball. I missed too many days of school in 1985, and I didn't want to go to summer school. And they just passed that law in 1985 to no matter what your grades were, if you mess too many days, you have to go to summer school. And I wasn't going to go to summer school, and I wanted money one or the other. And next thing you know, I started dealing a little bit of drugs, and next thing you know, that I brought in my first 10,000-pound load of marijuana and never looked back. It was influenced.
So the appeal was really just the money.
Thought it was cool, yep. I thought it was cool. Wanted to be like everybody else, like a lot of kids go through today. You know, they're a product of their environment. And I would, like I said, I had a good family, great family, but it doesn't matter. Drugs does discriminate. You know, you could be in a big city, small city, country, town, wherever. It's everywhere. And kids want, you know, they see that, and they're just influenced. And that's what happened.
Boy, you were big time. I mean, Pablo Escobar cartel?
Yes, I was moving up the ladder, and we're contractors. You know, we bring in a load of pot, and you own the load. You pay me so much to get it to shore, and I get it to you in Miami. You're the owner. You know, you guys make a lot of you guys make most of the money. We just make a percentage of the loads, depending on the size of loads. We still made a lot of money. Yes. We are basically contractors, smuggling contractors is what they call it. Get the load to shore, and next thing you know, I'm over in Miami, sitting there in a big mansion, and that's how I got in the Cuban gang. I was a young white kid, and they use it to their advantage. Mm-hmm. You know, and next thing you know, I'm bringing 30,000-pound loads. They wanted me to work for them and drive millions of dollars around the warehouse.
You didn't have any reservations? You weren't worried about anything?
Well, everybody else, you know, back in the 1970s and 80s, South Florida down here in Everglades City was 10,000 islands.
Right.
You know, it was smuggler's paradise back in the day, and that's, you know, that's what, I was cleaning boats at 14 years old, cleaning the boats from loads that came in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was never planning on getting into that. I had scholarships. Deion Sanders was my high school rival in high school. He went to North Fort Myers. I was a star down here in South Florida, and we were high school rivals against each other, chasing the scoring title in South Florida. And I was going to North Carolina University is what my dream was, you know. I didn't have a scholarship there at that time, but I had other scholarships to smaller schools and stuff like that. But that was my dream. I never envisioned, after I wrote that book, I couldn't believe that was me in that story. You know, couldn't believe that was me.
Did your family know? Did they suspect?
Oh, yeah, my mother and them, they knew that, yes, yes. You know, I was a young kid. I had a lot of money. And
I started to say, how were you? You must have had a lot of money. What did you do with it?
Bought houses, toys, girls for my friends, and limos and planes, you know, plane rides, and just enjoyed it.
So you were known as the drug dealer. People knew.
Yeah, yeah. I was, well,
there's no real secret thing.
Yeah, yeah, but a lot of the Fed, the CIA, they didn't know who the West Coast kid was. They just knew of the West Coast kid. They didn't know it was Travis Waters.
Okay.
At the time, yes, until that all came out, when they finally found who really was the man behind the West Coast kid name.
How long did it take them to figure this out?
About three to 4 years. You know, we got indicted. They were watching us for like probably two, three, probably almost 4 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, you know, I was actually kidnapped. Everything for that load. And I want kids to see all that. It's just not going to prison. When you're out, you're going to get killed and a drug deal gone bad. You're going to be beaten up. There's no positives going to come from it. And you read that in the book. And I didn't, when I wrote that book, I didn't sugarcoat it.
Mm-hmm.
I cleaned it up a lot. But I also left in there what's going to happen to you in the drug deals. What's going to happen to you in prisons, sexually assaulted. You're going to be beaten. You're going to see that stuff every day. And every day in some of those places, it's just to try to survive, to make it out of there alive if you're lucky. And I want them to see all that. I detailed the smells that you're going to smell, the molds, the sweats, everything that goes on in there. And that's how I wrote it from my perspective. And from what I went through, I didn't write like a textbook because my book's in high schools, treatment centers, court order centers. It's mandatory reads in some centers and high schools right now. And my goal is to have it every high school in the country and treatment centers. It's not a textbook. I wrote it from the beginning to the end because kids today read, they want to read a story. They don't want to read a textbook. They don't want to do that.
Exactly.
I've had kids read this book from teachers, counselors, court order people, everything that it's the first book that they've ever read from cover to cover, and it inspires them to read more books. So I'm very excited about that.
Are there warning signals that you would share with parents? That they may, there are things that they may pick up or they may question or they may wonder.
Yes, well, I speak at schools, centers, like I treatment centers, I speak all these places. And my number one thing is kids is staying up all night, sleeping all day, losing weight, avoiding eye contact with their parents, hanging around different crowds. And that is one of the main things that you have to look out for. Nobody knows their kids better than their parents. They know their routines. They know their schedules. So if they start seeing some of these symptoms, the grade dropping and everything like that I just explained, then there's something going on. And also the main thing, too, with the drug use now, it's not really just the heroin, cocaine, and the marijuana. It's more the prescription pills, especially here in Florida, and then Florida leads to around the country with that.
Mm-hmm.
And prescription pill use, the medicine cabinets. If you do have family members in your family that live with you and the kids have access to pain pills, Vicodin, Percocets, whatever the people you have in your house might be on, Xanaxes, whatever it may be, always check that or lock up your medicine cabinets. That's the biggest thing the kids are doing is the medicine cabinets. It's easy access. It's easier to get the marijuana.
Yeah, now marijuana was
my... And I hear all this from talking to them. That's the feedback I get.
So
I do my speaking engagements.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how the pill epidemic's taken over.
Well, you know, I don't think that parents really appreciate how significant prescription drugs are.
No, seven people a day die in Florida from just prescription drug abuse every day. Seven people a day die here. That's the statistics. We prescribe pills here in Florida than all the states combined at one time we do in a year. Well, all the states combined. So especially the people living in Florida on the East Coast and all that, it's they know what's going on. I mean, you know, it's all over the news and all over the papers. And the federal government is cracking down on a lot of those pill mills. They are getting mm-hmm. getting a handle on that. It was just totally out of control. Doctors dealing drugs, you know, basically it's what it's like. It was all about money, just like it was for illegal drug smugglers. It's all about money. It comes down to money. It doesn't matter about everything else.
Is there a particular profile that the drug dealers look for in kids?
Not really. I was a clean-cut kid. I still don't have any tattoos. I have all my teeth. I was an all-American kid. I was school's first grade player. I sold the records of my high school. My parents owned the biggest companies in South Florida at the time I was growing up. They profiled me as a clean-cut kid that would drive their millions of dollars around for them and not get caught. Mm-hmm. That's how they use me. So, no, I don't, you know, you can't get into the guy that's got the tattoos and think that he's the guy or this is – everybody's the guy when they're involved with that. You know what I mean? It's you know, you can't just sit there and say, well, that guy's got tattoos. He must be the drug dealer. That guy's got long hair. I was a clean-cut kid like you see on a cereal box or something, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I was an all-American kid. Yeah. And look what happened to me. Influenced, peer pressure. You think it's cool. And a lot of kids, you know, and a lot of these kids that live in these inner cities like that, too, in these big cities around, I feel for them because it's all they know. Their cousins are doing it. Their brothers are doing it. And they don't have opportunities like a lot of these other kids. I will get back to it doesn't matter where you're at. It doesn't discriminate. You know, you can be from a rich family, a middle-class family, a family that's not as fortunate as other families. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But it's a product of their environment. But I do know that a lot of kids that are in harder hit areas that they don't have a lot of opportunities, and you can relate to what I'm saying, mm-hmm. right? You know, it will. They are the most are going to be the most problematic because of that, not because that they're just born to be that. It's just it's where they're living and their environment they're set in. That's sad for me when I see that.
That environment.
That's all they know. And then you got all these other advocates that sit there and say, oh, well, that's not that. It's their parents. They don't have this. They don't have that. But it's all they know. Mm-hmm. And they have to do something to eat. They have to put food on the table. I mean, mm-hmm. they got kids. Mm-hmm. They got family. They got mm-hmm. single family mothers. You know, it's like that.
Mm-hmm. And are there just as many males as females involved? I mean,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It is. And it's like I said, it doesn't discriminate, you know, drugs are, and it's, like I said, I try to do everything I can, and I know that I've saved a lot of lives already because I get all the emails, all the support from teachers, counselors, PAL, the police athletic leagues here, my book's in, it's in programs. I just now was invited to, Collier County, drug-free county, meetings for next week. So it's just taken off like crazy, and I'm very overwhelmed with it that my story has helped so many and is helping so many, and I do what I can. You know, there's no guarantee with mm-hmm. no one, but, you know, you keep every day you save one, somebody saved. You helped, and that's all that matters.
How does someone contact you? I mean,
through my website.
Okay, share that with us
It's thewestcoastkid.com. You can contact me through there and go on there and see all the links and see all the photos of centers that I talk to, because when I centers and all, I usually post photos and stuff of every with the kids, with the books and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I try to update it all the time and let you know there's news and events page and what's going on, where I'm going to be, stuff like that. This month here, actually, August 7th, I'm flying out to Indiana to do a Christian show on the Harvest Show out there, mm-hmm. For an interview out there as a guest on their show for what we're doing around the country. And that show is a, you know, international show, so that's good for all the kids and parents that want to watch that.
All right. Travis Waters is a youth counselor who went from star high school basketball player with hopes of a college scholarship to ranking associate for one of the most dangerous drug cartels in North America, almost overnight. After several years in prison, he has rebuilt his life and is dedicated to protecting young people from the consequences of involvement with illicit substances. He's sharing his story with 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily. What's the 411? You're tuned to 411 Teen. And if you're just joining in, I'm talking with Travis Waters. Currently, Travis tours as a motivational speaker, inspiring audiences at youth rehab facilities, local high schools, and youth groups. Travis shares his inspired struggle to find his place in life. He hopes to encourage young folks to make sound choices and follow their dreams in a productive, positive life. Travis, what do you say? What's your advice to young folks? I mean, it's so easy to take the wrong turn.
I tell them when they see those kids, they think that's cool hanging out in those new cars and those beautiful girls.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to rope them off into getting into their groups or their gangs and thinking it's cool. Run as fast as you can in the opposite direction, because I can guarantee you in 2 to 3 to 4 years, that guy will be either in prison, killed, dead, OD'd on drugs, or beaten up because of a drug deal gone bad, or spending the rest of his life in prison, and you'll be right there with him, because he's going to tell on you as soon as he gets caught. Run as fast as you can the other way, because I can guarantee you, at the end, it won't be worth it. It won't be worth it. When kids read my book, that's the way I wrote it, is at the end of the book, I want you to say, was that worth it, what you mm-hmm. go through from all the fun in the beginning and the money and the girls and the toys and then all the hell you're going to go through when you have to get out of your bunk to look in the mirror to see who's really looking back at you because you're so confused with the bizarre environments that you're in because you're in certain prisons. And is that really you? Was it worth it in the end? You go through all your beatings and your sexual assaults and stuff. And how are you going to come out the other end? How are you going to be with your life?
Well, can you share some of the changes that you went through?
What do you mean, during prison or since I've been home?
No, not since you've been home. Before you got to prison and during prison.
Well, I can say that you're going to go through some bizarre environments. You're not going to really believe that it's like there's really people like that out there when you're sitting there in prisons
mm-hmm.
or in cells and day rooms when 80% of the people in there got 3 or 4 life sentences or are killing 3 or 4 people.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see people wearing mental helmets that you're going to be going, what's that all about?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to, like I said, I'd have to get out of bed in the middle of the night to look in the mirror to see if that's really me in that mirror looking back at me to make sure that I'm still the Travis Waters, I'm still the all-American kid, I'm still a good kid. And you got to try not to become your environment, per se, when you're in that environment, when you're with a bunch of killers, wherever you may be in your prison sentence. And I tell kids, you will be going through these places no matter what your custody level is. Low level, medium level, high, you will mm-hmm. be going through some maximum security prisons. maybe by mistake, maybe by court ordered, but you'll be transferred through some of these places. And when you're young like that, there's sexual predators there eyeballing you the whole time. You're going to see and hear things you never even knew existed in your life. And I write all that, mm-hmm. a lot of that in the book because I want them to see that.
How did you survive? Given that all...
I didn't want to... I thought about killing myself, actually. I was going to kill myself, and because I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in there. I had other indictments coming down on me. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in there. I didn't want to have a boyfriend. There's a documentary also out that I did a documentary to. That's in high schools and treatment centers all over also. And I talked in there that I wanted to kill myself because I didn't want to be someone's boyfriend the rest of my life. I didn't, this bizarre behavior. I didn't want to have play sexual favorites. And me, when I went to prison, I grew 2 inches. I had a 35-inch vertical, 4'5", 4'3", 6'40", throw mm-hmm. a football, 55 yards, one step. I got bigger, faster, stronger. So prison gangs would force me to play against new arrivals to win money off them, mm-hmm. or they would beat me or sexually assault me if I didn't do it. And then when they find out I played against Deion, was my rival, Deion Sanders, mm-hmm. the other inmates felt like they were cheated, and they'd beat me up. Because if I was good enough to play against him and match him point for point in high school, and him and I were rivals, I cheated them in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I write all that in there, what kids are going to go through, because you don't know what you're going to become as you get older, because either though you're in high school, you're still going to grow up and get bigger and faster and stronger.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, looking at it from another perspective, what you're really talking about is choices. The choices
made
that...
Made one wrong choice. I wasn't going to summer school.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm going to have money one way or the other. And the biggest wrong choice of my life, you know. And, well, I went back to saying that my stepfather was a good family. Mm-hmm. My first real father, he used to beat my mother, was an alcoholic. My mother shot him 6 times. So I got to rephrase back on that, because I said, after that, I came with a good stepfather and mm-hmm. owned a big company and stuff like that, that raised me and took care of us. But my original father, he was an alcoholic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he would beat, and a lot of kids can relate to that I talk to in schools and stuff and treatment centers, that their parents were like that. Father's alcoholic, and they fight and beat their mothers. And they always ask me, they read the book, and then they always ask me, how did they go through some of this. How did I get through it? And I tell them, you just deal with it. You will move on. You will overcome. Life does go on. You can become something in your life. You don't have to give up and kill yourself. A lot of kids want to kill themselves, mm-hmm. you know, going through stuff like that, tragedies. And it's sad because they were just born. They weren't, it wasn't planned for them, you know. It wasn't planned for me. I was just born to this family, and this, my father was like that. And my mother had to actually shoot him. I was there when that happened.
And how do you think that early life impacted you?
I get asked that a lot. I don't know. Did it impact me to do wrong? No, I'm never like that. I dealt drugs because I thought it was cool, like everybody else was doing, and had family members doing it. I don't think that early childhood. I've never in my life beat girls or do that. I don't believe in all that stuff. So no, that didn't mm-hmm. do that to me. No.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I drink and party, but no, I never hit girls, never smack girls. That happened to my mother. You know, I'm against that big time.
How do you feel about yourself now?
Happier now in my life than I have been. I'm a lot happier than I used to be because in the drug game, it was so stressful. I was looking over your shoulder, not knowing if you're going to get killed, especially when the load that I got indicted on that got ripped off, and they were going to kill me and my partner for it because we were responsible. It was $15-18 million.
Mm-hmm.
That was what it was worth on the streets. Even though we don't make that much, you know, we're contractors, but still, we were responsible for the load, and the feds had it ripped off, the government had it ripped off to get Pablo Escobar. And just the stress of it, I don't know how I got through it, to be honest with you. I look back at that, and I don't even know myself how we just did. We got lucky. They almost got thrown out of a plane. They were going to throw him in a plane, put me to a warehouse, electrocuted me for the load.
What did you say?
In prison, I was in hospital, prison hospital like 13 or 15 days, I forget, and almost died in there from one of the beatings from sports. Yes. That's all in there.
Mm.
And how do I make it through it? I just did. I have dealt with it like I dealt with everything when I was a little kid with my mom and dad beatings and stuff like that. You know, I just dealt with it. Mm. And when I wrote that book, it was therapy for me, big time mm-hmm. therapy for me. Mm-hmm. I pushed away and said, that's it. Here's what happened to Travis Waters.
Well, we certainly commend you writing the book because I think you are a very powerful spokesperson because you can say, hey, look, this happened.
Yeah,
but you also can say, I'm still here.
I'm still here. That's what I tell them. They look at me as a, you know, and now I coach and sponsor kids' teams. I'm a coach now, basketball mm-hmm. youth coach. I sponsor a bunch of teams. I give back. I donate a lot of books to centers, high schools, treatment centers. I do a lot of donations. And I just want to be back the All-American kid I used to be. That's who I am, and that's who I'm happiest being. And if I can, the way I'm doing and helping these kids and teenagers to save their lives and get, and I don't want any kid to go through that regardless of race or what I had to go through. When you read the book, you'll see what I'm talking about. If you read the book, that I don't want anybody to go through that. If anybody has a heart, a conscience, and all that, because if you make one bad mistake, what's going to happen to you? And my one mistake, look what happened to me. Mm-hmm. Huge, 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 huge mistake and tragedy and going through it. And lucky to be here to tell it.
Yeah. Yeah.
To share it.
What role do you think self-esteem plays in one getting caught up in this world of drugs?
What do you mean?
Were you feeling, do you think that feeling good about self or feeling bad about self or feeling like you have no other options?
You think it's cool. You want what everybody else has. When you mm-hmm. see that guy drives up in that $30,000-$50,000 car and he's on that $100,000 boat with the beautiful girls and he's got coolers full of money, it's you want that. I mean, you know, you're around that. It's like it's a product of your environment. And a lot of people say, oh, I wouldn't do that. No, but mm-hmm. when you're around it and you see it and you think it's cool and everybody else is doing it and, you know, these guys weren't carrying around machine guns like you see in Scarface like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like you carry around machine guns and stuff like that. It's just, it was the way it was, you know. It's like when you see these inner city kids with these guys pulling up in these big fancy cars and Cadillacs or whatever it may be, Escalades and, kids see that. Young kids see that. They think it's cool. And then you see the guy out there with the money. He's sitting there waving the money in front of the kids. Uh-huh. And it's product and environment. I think that there needs to be more celebrities. A lot of them give back now. There needs to be more celebrities and more famous people, whether it be sports figures or whatever. They need to be out in these inner cities doing that and letting them know that. And I tell all these kids, don't think the West Coast kid's cool. You know, some of them think it's cool. I say, because nothing's cool about it. I want it to be a trend that parents say 3 years from now, when their kid's messing up, do you want to be like the West Coast kid? That's what I want that to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, parents to say that to their kids. Do you want to end up like the West Coast kid? And like I said, I want the book in every high school and treatment center in the country, and it's taken off, and I'm very blessed. And the impact I hear from these teenagers and these parents and teachers tell me that their kids stop hanging around the wrong people, stop smoking pot, they're making straight A's and B's, they're back playing sports in schools because of my book. I know it's working, and it's amazing to me
mm-hmm.
that my book can have that power for them to turn their life around and not want to be like the West Coast kid. I never thought that.
Share again how one contacts you.
Through my website, thewestkid.com. You can contact me there if you know for your centers or if you need books for kids. I even sign them to you guys, to the centers and all that. I do a lot of giving back, and I will continue doing that. That's my goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, given that you got caught, do you think that's what saved you? Getting caught?
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
okay.
Because it was a short career, and I'm thank God because climbing up the drug ladder. I was going to start bringing in more loads of cocaine, more loads of marijuana, and I was learning out the. I learned the system. I learned how to set up the loads. I was doing all that, and it was a short career. Yeah, and we almost got killed on this load here,
mm-hmm.
and yes, I would have probably ended up being killed eventually. or prison the rest of my life. But and then you go to prison, you have to hopefully make out of there, because like I said, I almost got killed in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Now, how long were you in prison?
6 years and 10 days. Okay. Federal and state prison. I did federal first, and then I went to state prison right from federal prison.
Mm.
You know, and I write in there. And I woke up handcuffed, shackled to a bed. This was in a public hospital, covered from head to toe with blood. I didn't know who I was or nothing. You know, they tried to kill me there in a Florida prison.
In the prison they tried to kill you?
In Florida, in a state prison in Florida, yes. Over sports. Yeah. And I wrote that in there. And I want kids to see, was it worth it at the end? Was all that money that you read about with me and all those girls, all that fun, was it worth it? And that's why I didn't write it in a textbook, because you know and I know kids are not going to read anything if it's like a textbook. They want to read it as a story, and that's how I did it. And that's why I self-published it and did it my way. A lot of people wanted me to change this, change that. Thank God I stuck to the way I wanted to do it.
Yeah, I think so. I just got the book today in the mail. It was a breakdown, so I didn't receive it until today. So I look forward to
appreciate that.
To reading it, but it's a very, you know, riveting memoir that you are sharing with us.
Yes, kids need to know.
Mm-hmm.
They have to know. I mean, it's I cry a lot in that book. I cried a lot writing it, and I cried a lot in those scenes in that book, laying in my bed.
How do they react to you when you go to these schools?
They think I'm like a role model to them, inspiration to them. It's amazing the feedback they get. I can't explain it. Yeah, they just, I don't know. I think a lot of them can relate to having the parents, the beatings, the alcoholics, like I told you, and the temptations of drugs. And they, a lot of their family members are in prison on drugs, and cousins and uncles and all that stuff. And they just, you know, the West Coast kid, they think it's, like I said, a lot of them, I said, don't think it's cool. You know, I don't think it's the West Coast kid's cool. I see people in my hometown here, and the West Coast kid, I go through drive-thrus and stuff, fast food restaurants, and it's the West Coast. Hey, look, it's the West Coast kid, and it's not cool. And I tell them that when I think they think that in speaking engagements and talking to them, because I do Q&As with them. I usually sit down. I don't stand up and talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of them. I sit down.
Sit down.
In front when talking and do Q&As, because a lot of them, when I go to schools, the classrooms read my book, and we do Q&As, or I go to the youth centers on the East Coast of Florida. You know, it's yearly reads, the mandatory reads. They do have questions for me. We do Q&As. I sit there and talk to them and answer their questions, because they're inspired. You know, they love the book. They tell me they can't put it down, and they, the first book they've ever read, and that's what amazes me, from cover to cover. You know, so it's amazing how they react to it, and I don't want them to get the false sensation that it's cool, because, and I tell them that in the meetings when I'm talking to them, is it cool? Don't think that. No. After I read the book, I don't think it's cool. They told me. So.
How'd your parents handle this? How'd you feel?
Real father, the one that my mother shot, he was ordered to leave the state. He lives in North Carolina. He's not happy about it, because he knows I wrote what he did to me and to my mother and all this.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, she's all for it. In the documentary that's out, she was the first time she's ever spoke about why she shot him, and she, you know, and why she had to, and that's the first time she's talked about that, and she supports me, whatever, because she knows that she would live with me with my story, because she's all through the book, you know, she's the most lovable person in my life as my mother. She's never left me. I've been with her ever since, you know, my life. And I knew that being in prison would kill her. She wouldn't put up Christmas trees. She wouldn't celebrate no holidays, nothing, until I came home. And when they couldn't find me in one of the state prisons for like a month, my lawyers couldn't even find me, and they never gave me a phone call. They put me down in the hole, and they were scared I was going to escape in one of the prisons I first went from federal to state to, and they were scared of death. I was going to have helicopters come in there and get me, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing from the warden. And then I didn't get a phone call, and I knew my mom would thought that they took me out of this country and killed me. And then she finds out when I talked to her where I was at, and then I went to state, and then I was almost got killed up there in Rayford, Florida. She come up there to see me at the other place, but they transferred me. I was in a hospital, and she, you know, I tell the kids, you hurt everybody in your family. It's not just you. You destroy everybody's lives when you deal drugs and go to prisons and stuff. You tear down everybody's walls and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
What they're going to go through, and your mothers, your fathers, your uncles, your cousins, your sisters and brothers, you destroy everybody's lives for that time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what about siblings?
Now I have a Travis Jr. I coach his team also. He'll be 12 next week. I have a daughter, Olivia, a twin, and my son died, Nicholas, and I blame that on my past also. He died. So I blame that for all the punishment that I caused other families and bringing in the tons of drugs we were bringing in.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I still blame myself for his death. Yep. That God punished me more. You know, this is what I get. You know, after everything I've already been through, all the hell I've been through, that my son died, and I blame myself for that.
So it's had a real impact on your life and those around you, is what I hear.
Oh yeah, it does. You destroy everybody's lives when you get involved in drugs. There's no pop. My legendary coach, there's no positive that comes from it. He wrote the foreword for the book,
mm-hmm.
and there's no positive that will come from drugs, and nothing. And you think it's all fun and games at first. Everything's, you know, you're doing this, you're doing that, and you're the man. And at the end, you're left by yourself. All of the money, all the lawyers can't get you out of trouble. You're there by yourself in that cell, beaten, shackled, sexually assaulted, and that's what happened to me.
Well, hold your hold your thoughts for a brief moment. We're going to take a break. Tuned in to 411 Teen. This hour, I've been talking with Travis Waters. Travis tours the country as a motivational speaker and youth counselor, encouraging kids to stay on the straight and narrow. Travis is the author of The West Coast Kid, My Redemption. He chronicles the events that led to his stint in prison. Travis, were you rehabilitated in prison?
Was I rehabilitated? Yes. I'm definitely rehabilitated. Definitely never want to go back there again.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing what you see and what you go through, and I also explain to the kids that even though you're out, you're never free. I have nightmares of the past, and that no pills, no medication, no doctors, no therapists can get you out of that. I have nightmares of the past. I have nightmares of my father and my mother shootings and the beatings.
Mm-hmm.
I tell kids, that's normal. You're going to go through that, but just you'll wake up the next day. Don't do anything drastic. You will go through all those feelings, all those emotions you're going to go through. It never goes away. It never goes away. Yes, I'm rehabilitated and big time rehabilitated. But when I came home, I was scared because I was so institutionalized, you know, being out in the free world and stuff like that. It was hard to adjust. Mm-hmm. It was hard to adjust because you're so used to being on a schedule, and I felt like I was doing something wrong. Like I had to get back to my bunk or back to my dorm, and it was really hard to deal with. Yes.
How did your friends react? I mean, did they, those who were your buddies, continue to be your buddies?
What were some of the consequences,
I guess?
Yeah, a lot of the buddies that were in the prison with me, you know, I mean, were also went to prison because they were my buddies on the streets we were dealing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the high school people, they had no idea.
They
a lot of them were shocked, you know, that because they moved out of the state and stuff like that since high school, and then they saw that in the papers and stuff like that, and they never in their wildest dream that would believe that Travis Waters would end up in prison like that with everything I had going for me, you know. They all thought I was in college playing ball somewhere. You know, a lot of the people that went to other schools and stuff like that too that didn't know, you know, that didn't know me after school. Yep, never dreamed that would happen to me.
What did you learn in prison?
I learned not to trust anyone. Everyone's out for something, it seems like. And you do meet a lot of good people in there. I can't sit there and badger everyone because you do meet a lot of good people in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't like that. I was a good person. So, yeah, you do meet a lot of good person, but you just don't. It's hard to trust anyone. You learn that when you're in certain environments like that there's people in there that's never getting out, and they act the way they do because they're a product of their environment. They have no choice. Most people go in there being straight, and they're sexual predators, you know, against mm-hmm. younger people because that's all they know. And like I said, you look yourself in the mirror a lot. I'd have to get out of bed to look in the mirror. You know, like I said, I stopped believing in God and everything after a while because those environments you're in, and I explained that to all the kids. And I write a lot of that, about that in the book, about the emotions and everything and the bizarre environments you're going to go through.
Mm-hmm. One theme I hear through our whole conversation when we talk about just some of the circumstances that led to this and what parents need to be aware of is the environment.
For me, you know, I watch
a
lot of...
Yeah.
For me, it's the environment, and I was watching the O'Reilly Factor the other night, and I agree with him on this point that it comes from the core of the parenting and your families and your environment,
mm-hmm.
and that's where it stems from. And like I said, you can't sit there and blame the inner city kids for what they're doing as much because if they don't have the opportunities the other fortunate kids have with schooling and education and money. And tools to help them better their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a product of their environment. That's all they know. That's all they're going to know. Until a lot of that gets changed and helped, you're still going to have a lot of these crack dealers, drug dealers, street dealers, and now with the pills. And you can't sit here and point the finger at all them because in Florida, the doctors are dealing drugs just as much as the drug dealers on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I see that.
So what I hear you saying is that society plays a big role.
Society plays a big role in it, but they'll never, a lot of them, the advocates won't come out and say that.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing is they're wanting to legalize marijuana. And I actually I was invited on the Piers Morgan show a few nights ago or a week ago, but I didn't make it in time. They were doing a thing on legalization of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's even aired yet, but I don't even know who's on the show, but I was invited if I wanted to be on there to call in.
How do you feel about that? What's your position
on
that?
No way should they legalize marijuana because I'll tell you right now, if they legalize marijuana, what's going to happen?
What?
You're going to see an influx of cocaine. You're going to see an influx of heroin. You're going to see an influx of crack, ecstasy, all the pills. When you take that marijuana market from those smugglers, it's going to be an epidemic of cocaine.
Oh, okay.
Cocaine. See, they don't talk about all that. Take legalized marijuana, and you'll see the influx of cocaine, ecstasy, heroin smuggling into this United States.
Because it's about money, right?
Because it's about money.
And so if you legalize
And the marijuana is not the money trade anyway.
Right,
They don't make nothing like they do with the other drugs.
Right.
So legalize marijuana, then you're going to see all the black market dealers on the marijuana, a lot of robberies in the factories and the pot farms and all that. Be a lot of robberies and all that. Who's going to benefit from it? The government and the states.
Mm-hmm.
Fast food restaurants, fast food chains, doctors from the high use of marijuana over 20 years and 15 years of use of all these ailments they're going to have from smoking marijuana so much because it's worse than cigarettes. It's like four times, one joint's like four times the amount of one cigarette, one joint is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's who's going to benefit from it: the government, the state, taxes, money, doctors, fast food restaurants, food.
And you say fast food restaurants. Why fast food restaurants?
Smoking marijuana. What's it do to you? Pizza delivery guys are going to be rich. Fast food restaurants. And think about it. We already have an epidemic of obesity in this country.
That's
Could you
true.
Imagine unlocking the drug box on marijuana and letting that be free? What that would do to the obesity in this country? I'm wondering how the United States could even produce enough food to feed everybody if they did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because my days when I smoked marijuana, all I wanted to do was eat and lay on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it doesn't do any, you'd have no motivation. You know, no motivation. And marijuana, I know they don't say it's a gateway, but I know everybody that smokes marijuana has ended up doing cocaine, heroin, and other drugs because of marijuana. And their false things are they start doing harder drugs, they stop marijuana. No, they don't stop marijuana. They still smoke marijuana. They just do other harder drugs with it because marijuana brings them down from their highs of crack, speed, cocaine, and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
and ecstasy. So they think... The advocates think, oh, it's not the gateway. No, it is the gateway. But they don't stop smoking just because they started doing cocaine. They still smoke the pot, too. They don't just give it up. Pot's always going to be there, you know, when they're doing harder drugs. But I'm way against opening up that drug box, unlocking that drug box, and letting that marijuana be free to society. Do you think a 15-year-old kid's going to be a responsible pot smoker? That's what I hear, too, on these shows
mm-hmm.
I watch. That the advocates say that the parents are responsible pot smokers. Do you think a 14-year-old kid's going to be a responsible pot smoker? Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
It's a big, big no-no in my book to do that, to legalize marijuana. And I'm hoping I do get on one of those shows because I'm going to tell them my thoughts of it, my experiences with it, and who will benefit and who won't benefit from it.
Well, it's all about money, though.
That's all it's about.
That's what it's about.
Just like with the doctors and the pill mills, it's all mm-hmm. about money. And they know that. The government knows mm-hmm. that. The states know that. And that's just the way it is. But I'm against it, and I'll be an advocate against it because I know what it's going to do. If you think you got a cocaine problem now in this country, legalize marijuana and see what all cocaine and heroin is going to be in this country now. Because you're going to take that market from the smugglers, that money out of the way, and it's just going to be an influx of cocaine. It'll be an epidemic. You'll see.
Well, given your experience, do you think the government really wants to eradicate drugs?
I think they want to eradicate. I don't know. I know that they spend billions and billions of dollars on saying they do
mm-hmm.
and putting it through. But you know,
but we're just scratching the surface.
It's the same. It's the same thing. Like, do they ever have a cure for cancer? Do they or don't they? Because
mm-hmm.
billions of dollars are spent on that every year. Billions. And they have all this technology that they have now, but you're telling me they don't have cures for all cancers yet? So would it put all doctors out of work, all chemo people out of work?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like the drug business. So I don't know. You know, I don't know. I can't really answer that. But I don't think that when there's the demand, there's always going to be a supply for it.
Okay.
And by them trying to legalize it, it's going to be a big, huge mistake. But if that happens, the only way it's going to happen is for money. Now, I'm all for legalizing it for medical use.
Medical purposes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I'm all for that because they have everything else they use for medical use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the other pills, synthetic heroin and stuff they use for medical use. And people do, if they need it, they need it. But for legalizing it to the public, I just, and they always say, there's nobody ODing on marijuana. No kid, nobody's ever ODing on marijuana. No, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guarantee you, there'll be a lot of people ODing on cocaine and more heroin when they legalize marijuana and let them smoke it freely and see what it leads to. So what are your thoughts on that? You agree?
I just don't know. I mean, to be real candid with you,
right.
You know, I don't know where things stand. You know, that's why I was asking you, because you have a better handle on exactly what's happening, you know, in the drug trade. I often wonder, do we really want to, because the money talks.
It's always everything.
And money is really the root of it.
Yes.
And so that's why I asked, do you think we really want to, you know, eradicate these drugs? I'm talking, you know, heroin is now a big deal. I mean, there's a big comeback with heroin, from what I understand.
And heroin's a huge comeback.
Yeah.
Like I said, legalizing marijuana, you're going to see it really come back more than it is right now. It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. And it's affordable now more than it used to be. It's more affordable now. And they're never going to stop it if there's always a demand for it. And that's just the way it is. And there's so much money. It's money. It's even though they're not taxing it, you know how much they confiscate in monies and cash,
mm-hmm.
and cars and houses and boats. I know of guys that have cooperated and they've gotten hundreds of or millions of dollars worth of everybody they bust and cash and boats and houses. You know that I read about down here, and plus stuff we're involved in. It's money. Also,
mm-hmm.
who knows? You know, I can't answer that. Only they can answer that, the government. But I do know that the government stuck 10,000 more extra pounds on our load. I know the government stuck 10,000 more pounds of marijuana on our 30,000-pound load,
mm-hmm.
and they used it to get the cartels or whatever they wanted to use it for to do buys with the coke, with the marijuana, to sell the marijuana, trade it for guns, whatever they did. They added 10,000 more pounds on our load. And then our government also busted our load, knowing that it was going to be busted. It was set up from the beginning.
Oh.
I write all that in the book, so that you can make your own conclusion off of what you're
mm-hmm.
just asking me right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's why I asked you that. I mean, I didn't know that specifically, but, you know, those type of scenarios I've definitely been familiar with, you know,
right.
and heard. So that's why I asked you.
Well, I'm very familiar with that part
mm-hmm.
of it because I wrote it and it happened to me. And so you'll see that.
Well, Travis, I mean, I thank you so much.
Well, thanks
for sharing this. Any closing comments that you'd like to say?
No, and just I appreciate you having me, help you spread my message to these parents and stuff like that are listening. And, you know, always keep an eye on your kids because
mm-hmm.
There's no guarantees and nobody's perfect. And definitely, like I said, if you have any painkillers or any kind of drugs like that in your medicine
mm-hmm.
cabinets and you suspect anything with your kids because you know your kids better than anybody, lock up your medicine cabinets. Start there.
Share one more time. Contact information.
TheWestCoastKid.com.
Okay.
My book is The West Coast Kid, My Redemption.
All right. Well, that's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411. And thanks for coming.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in WFSU.org.